Dave.
A podcast of the cinema.
Hey.
Hey. You're Dave White. I'm Alonzo Duraldi.
Yeah.
We're film critics. We're spouses. And this is our show.
That was to the point.
Pretty much. Trying to cut through all the chaff.
That's not what we do, though.
Yeah, this is the chaff hour.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
I mean, it was yesterday.
It was yesterday.
But you got one gift yesterday, and you're going to get another gift today.
From you.
From me.
I've gotten other gifts.
They're not important.
I see.
You only have eyes for the gifts that come from me.
That's not true. I don't want
that
people,
is true.
I don't want people who sent me gifts to think that I don't care about them just because they aren't the ones that, what you got me. But I'm very excited.
I'm sure they
it.
Meant well.
I'm very excited about everything that you are. Only handmade gifts this year.
There's only one star in a Dave White show. That's me, baby. Remember?
Yeah. You made me a very delicious lasagna yesterday, and later I'm getting a beautiful cake. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
There was, listen, a lasagna done properly is a
thing of beauty.
It's a day-long affair.
Yes.
No more time. There's no time left after that for a cake.
And you really...
Also, we ate it for lunch and dinner.
You went all out with this thing.
I did.
So
I
great
certainly did.
Because... Listeners to our show, Linoleum Knife and Fork, if you're a Patreon subscriber, patreon.com/linoleumknife, know that you are really good at making, and I'm very happy to be eating, the bolognese sauce from Ruth Reichel's book, My Kitchen Year.
Yeah.
And at some point years ago, you were like, ooh, what if I made lasagna with this? And I was like, yes. When? And so finally, for the occasion of my birthday, when you asked me what I wanted you to make me, I said, I want the lasagna with the bolognese sauce.
You, in spite of the, you know, in spite of the lockdown, quarantine, joblessness
thing,
everything, you're also getting a little present.
Oh.
It'll be arriving in the mail. When I say little, it's a little present.
Okay. One tic tac.
What, you're checking my emails now?
Just a wild guess.
What I'm finding in this time,
especially now,
with you here in the house, with you all day, every day, is that there's still so much to do. I keep hearing from, you know, people out there, out in the world who are like, oh, I've got nothing to do. I'm just here at home and I'm just watching movies all day. And like
learning Italian.
Learning a language and stuff. And I'm like, what?
How does that work?
Who's cooking? Who's washing the clothes? Like, why are you, what's happening with folks who have all this leisure? In the middle of it all.
They don't have,
I feel
they
like
clearly
we don't
have a
stop.
Podcast.
Well, yeah, they aren't doing 5 podcast episodes a week. I suppose there's that.
Yes.
But even that, I mean, like, that's a few hours out of our day.
Mm-hmm.
The preparation and the execution.
Well, there's all the viewing of things.
Right. It does. Yeah, if we just had a podcast where we just talked out of our butts the whole time, I mean, we kind of do.
I was
like,
going to say,
if we,
not a stretch,
if
but
we,
if there weren't any preparation,
if there were no cultural objects to observe, to think about, and to, you know, synthesize into a conversation, that would really cut down on our workload.
Yes. Alas.
Sorry for the ice cube that's jiggling in my iced tea.
Alas, in a podcast of the cinema, we have to actually watch cinema first.
I've got such a good iced tea plan for the right next couple weeks.
That's great.
This first batch of it's the summertime. Like, I've decided it's summertime now.
Sure.
Yeah. this first batch was unsweetened Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
Then I have two hibiscus bags that I've used to make the next batch. I love hibiscus iced tea.
I see.
Then, when that one's over, back to Louisiana,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to make sweet tea. I've decided...
Now, are you making sweet tea,
mm-hmm.
or are you making sweet tea? Because there's iced tea that has been sweet. Granted, I don't drink iced tea, so this is all theoretical to me.
Something wrong with you.
There is iced tea that has been sweetened, and then there is the Southern sweet tea, which is a whole nother thing.
I like a medium sweet tea.
Okay.
If you put like 2 cups of sugar in the pitcher,
uh-huh.
then you're not gonna have me on board. Because there's a certain point at which sweet things overwhelm you.
So if we went into a, let's say, a Waffle House in Laurel, Mississippi, and they brought you a sweet tea,
I'd drink it.
Okay.
No, any restaurant that brings me a heavy-duty sweet tea,
uh-huh.
it's going right. I'm gulping it right now.
I see.
You're talking to the man who loves Hawaiian punch. Just remember.
No, I've watched you drink coffee, and it's a horror to behold. So I didn't know what the cutoff was for you exactly.
But I do like, if I'm making it here at home,
mm-hmm.
I like a medium sweet tea.
Okay.
I don't want it to be, you know, lightly sweet, a kiss of sweetness,
a whisper of
barely there.
Sugar.
And I don't like to feel like my foot will fall off if I drink a cup of it.
Yes.
But somewhere in the middle.
Okay.
Like I can't get down with, may he rest in peace, the lovely Andy Jones.
I was wondering if we were going to cite Anderson Jones in this conversation.
One must always cite Anderson Jones.
I was thinking about him, yes.
In this scenario. He was the friend who came to our home and when, upon finding red Kool-Aid in the fridge, said, "Oh, red Kool-Aid, I want some." I poured him a glass. He took a sip, he spit it into the sink and said to me, "White people Kool-Aid." Anderson Jones was black. He's no longer with us. I'm sorry to report. He died in 2008, 2007, something like that.
It's been a while now.
It's been a very long time now. He then got the sugar out of the cabinet, put another entire cup of sugar in the Kool-Aid. I had followed the directions
mm-hmm.
of the Kool-Aid.
Your first mistake, apparently.
1 cup of sugar per Kool-Aid packet.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the directions.
Right.
He put a second cup in, stirred it up. You could still see it clouding, swirling around his head. Take a big gulp. He said, "Now it's good."
Ooh.
I was like, "Well, no one in this house wants to drink that now, but I'm glad you're happy."
I just remembered. didn't we used to have like a plastic Kool-Aid pitcher that had like the Kool-Aid man face on it?
No.
Am I imagining this?
No.
I swear we had a... No. Okay. All right. I thought that was a thing that we owned at one point.
But I will never forget white people Kool-Aid. I was like, "I'm sorry. Have I offended you?"
You know what? I feel very self-conscious about potato salad now. That's become a thing. Summertime hits.
White people potato
salad?
White
people potato salad.
Well, you know, here's the thing.
As though I were putting miniature marshmallows in it or something.
White people potato salad is not... I've had all kinds of potato salads.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never not liked one of them.
You have to, I mean...
I like a mustardy one. I like a mayonnaise-y one. I like that one that you make that's like, got the bacon uh-huh. in it. I've had every kind of potato salad that you can have.
A really pale, like, deli or cafeteria potato salad?
I'll eat that, too.
Oh, no, I get why that's a problem, but... Homemade potato salad? I don't see what the line is.
Just don't put, like, weird fruits or raisins or stuff in it.
Some people do.
Some people do that, and that's bad and wrong.
Absolutely not.
People put weird things in potato salad, and that's what happens. No, Andy never complained about the potato salad.
Okay.
But he did take me to task about the Kool-Aid, and I'm sorry, but I wasn't wrong. He was wrong.
Look, it's what
that Kool-Aid got poured down the sink.
Yeah, no, but that's one of those things though, where like you are taught to drink Kool-Aid at like age 5,
yeah,
in a certain way, and that's just your tongue is like this is what a
this
Kool-Aid
is what it's
is,
supposed to be, yeah. Right? Yes, listen, all cultures are good.
Yes,
enjoy food the way you want to enjoy food.
In your own refrigerator.
In your own refrigerator. Come into my house, pour sugar into everything. I've already specifically calibrated the sugar content. And I do not have a light hand with
this
it.
This is true, yes. You were not sparing.
Where did we go off on this Kool-Aid conversation?
Your sweet tea.
Sweet tea.
Yes.
I'll drink any kind of sweet tea, mm-hmm. but if I'm making it for myself, mm-hmm. I know how much sugar I need in it.
I see.
And I only make it like every few months because I could drink sweet tea every day.
I see.
And be happy. My body would not like that though.
I just think I have one of my brothers used to, especially in the summertime, constantly drink Nesty.
Sure, why not?
The powder instant-y kind.
Yeah, who cares? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, like that lady on Instagram or Twitter or whatever, or Facebook, who made the powdered tea and Tang and lemonade, Country Time lemonade concoction, and then like heated it up in the microwave and said, "This is my tea." And I'm like, ma'am. Go away. No. Probably a flat earther, too.
The dowager is not down for your tea. I'm sorry.
Can you please make quick work of Scoob?
Sure. It is the big movie of the week, but you couldn't be bothered.
I feel, well, unfortunately, I was bothered by it.
You were bothered, that's true.
I was completely bothered by it, and I think I've watched enough. I watched enough of it in my ins and outs of the living room to help you with this review.
Okay, fair enough. So, this is it starts like an origin story. We get the meeting of young Shaggy and Scooby, Dooby-Doo, whom he names, on Venice Beach, young Shaggy, being voiced by Ian Armitage,
young Sheldon. Yeah.
Who, as we also now know, has a thing for Sondheim.
Can sing a Sondheim song like he means it, like he's like a 10-year-old little boy, Elaine Stritch.
Exactly.
Go to YouTube, you'll find this.
Watch,
it's great.
Watch the
kid is a national treasure.
The Sondheim birthday thing that just happened, and there's the footage of him as like a 5-year-old doing finishing the hat. It's amazing. Anyway, and then they go out for Halloween, and they run into Fred, Daphne, and Velma. Velma is of course dressed as RBG for Halloween. And they go into what appears to be a haunted house, and turns out that it's not really haunted, and the ghost is actually a guy in a mask, and this, of course, sets them on the path for the rest of their lives. And then we jump ahead to the present, and they are trying to make Mystery Inc. into a viable business option, which means meeting with Simon Callow? Sorry, Cowell. Simon Cowell.
Simon Cowell.
Oh, God, I wish
don't
Simon Cowell had been in
don't
this.
Don't get it mixed up. Now.
Sorry, they're very different people.
They are.
Simon Cowell, who basically tells them that Shaggy and Scooby are not focused enough, so they get hurt and go off on their own.
Right.
And then when they're at the bowling alley that night, the bowling alley, of course, is named for like one of the directors of the original series. Like, there are little Easter eggs for hardcore Hanna-Barbera fans littered throughout this thing.
Right.
The bowling pins come to life, and they're evil robots, which are known as Rottens that are all under the control of Dick Dastardly.
Yeah.
Who is trying to...
Explain Dick Dastardly.
Dick Dastardly was the villain of an old Hanna-Barbera cartoon called The Wacky Races.
Yeah.
This whole movie... Okay, so I said it started as an origin story. It then becomes a superhero movie where the superhero is Blue Falcon and Dino-Mutt. But in this iteration, Dino-Mutt is now smart and the Blue Falcon is now an idiot.
Right.
He's the original Blue Falcon's quote-unquote large adult son, as the movie calls him.
Yeah.
But it's also creating this, like, MCU version of Hanna-Barbera. So you have Dick Dastardly as the villain. There are passing references to Laugh Olympics and Hong Kong Phooey and Squiddly Diddly. And
did you mention Captain Caveman as well?
He pops up later. We get to Captain Caveman, voiced by Tracy Morgan. Yeah, so it's a lot of things, and there are a goodly amount of laughs in this thing. Like, mm-hmm. It's actually kind of funny. There are some good jokes, but it is so shrill and frantic and noisy and untrusting of an audience to follow along with it. And also, like, but
its audience is five.
Fine, but it's in a way that the original Scooby-Doo cartoons never had to do.
Right.
And I understand kids are sophisticated now. You can't have these people running in front of the same vase painting.
Sure you can.
Door over and over and over again.
Yeah.
But it's just too much. And by the time the plot really kicks into gear and there's a whole, like, third act sacrifice that winds up, it's a lot. And, you know, we talked about it on Breakfast All Day, and we were saying, like, the whole point of the old Scooby-Doo is that they never actually faced a real supernatural threat. It was always a guy in a mask.
Yeah.
And this one, it does have real supernatural threats, but then apparently later somebody said, oh, well, since the late 90s, there have been genuine supernatural things in Scooby-Doo.
Oh, okay.
News to me.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I can't.
So we're going to have, the sequel's going to have an exorcism then.
No, because I mean, whatever comes up in this one is vanquished.
I want an Exorcist Scooby-Doo crossover.
Something new will happen with a cartoon Max von Sydow. You know, I had some fun watching this. I can't completely dump on it.
But it's
a lot.
There are a medium serving of funny one-liners.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I just randomly walked through the living room and heard people saying funny stuff and was laughing.
Yeah.
But that's just like crumbs thrown at the grown-ups.
Basically.
That's not for the kids. For the kids, what they've delivered is, you know, the kind of children's film that I despise. Cacophony.
Mm-hmm.
Just nonstop noises on top of noises on top of noises that never let up. And when they do, it's to allow for a blast of a song cue to come in.
Right. You know what movie entertains 5-year-olds? Paddington 2.
Paddington 2.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So don't blame them.
Don't blame who?
5-year-olds.
Listen, the 5-year-olds are indiscriminate. They may love Paddington 2 if you show it to them.
But they'll love this.
But they'll love this.
Sure.
Like, this vomiting up of, you know, visually assaulting stuff and noisy assaulting stuff. I understand, you know, people who work on the technical end of this sort of thing. They are doing their jobs and they're doing them well.
Yeah.
This is as technically accomplished as any contemporary piece of animation that exists. You know, the kind that we see now in theaters.
I mean, it's not Studio Ghibli. Let's not get crazy. It is, however, not what you would expect from a big screen outing of a TV show from Hanna-Barbera, which for decades was known for being like, they weren't Filmation, but they were chintzy-ish. Again, they were running in front of that same painting, vase, and doorway over and over and over again.
Hanna-Barbera was Studio Ghibli compared to Filmation.
Yes. that said, this is kicking it up to what passes for like big studio animation. Like, this is a thing that Warner Brothers can put their name on and not feel like they're also ran
right.
A friend of ours worked on this movie, and we have friends who work on these kinds of films all the time. Yeah. It's never the technical accomplishment that is in question. It's the production design. Yeah. It's the what are we going to give people-ishness of it? You know, I feel like these films contribute to people having an inability to breathe, to deal with silence.
Well, somebody decided
to deal with things that go a little less slow than a frantic pace.
Yeah, somebody decided at some point that kids' movies just weren't allowed to like pause for a moment,
right?
You know, and again, like with the wonderful exception of something like a Paddington 2, for the most part, there is like a constant sound bed, and there is just like thing and thing and thing and thing and thing, and that just gets tiring. And I think that
maybe that's the point. Maybe your kids are supposed to be worn out by it when they're done so that they'll go have a nap. That might be it. We don't know.
No, I think, again, it's about not trusting even the five-year-olds in the audience to sort of, like, be engaged and attentive and interested in what's going on. There's, like, too much plot in this movie. There's more MacGuffins than it needs to have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they cast a bunch of celebs as the main voices.
Right.
Which is sort of like...
pointless.
Yeah, do we need that? Especially
when... pointless. It's good for the actors. They get to go to work in their pajamas. Yeah, but it's literally phone in their dialogue.
But it's crappy for, like, the animation actors who've been doing the grunt work for decades on television.
Yep.
And then the big movie comes along and suddenly it's like, oh, you were in the Broadway show, but we're not interested in you anymore because we've signed this big star. you know, and they don't... none of them really... I mean, like, yeah, is Zac Efron good as Fred? Sure. Did we need Zac Efron to be Fred? Not really. I mean, I think celebrity voices in cartoons, for the most part, is gimmicky. But particularly when they're playing established characters where you're getting a copy of a copy of a copy. You know, like, we're not even getting Matthew Lillard doing his take on Casey Kasem's version of Shaggy. We're getting Will Forte doing his version of Matthew Lillard's take of Casey Kasem's version of Shaggy.
True. Okay, well, it's not good, so let's move on.
I would be curious to see what a Hanna-Barbera extended universe looks like that isn't a superhero story. And I think they could do that. I mean, that's what Laugh Olympics was. That's what, you know, Yogi's Ark was. Like, they have managed to throw these characters together in various, you know, permutations and combinations before without having to be a superhero movie. But we'll see what happens.
Capone.
Oh, brother.
I will explain. Josh Trank, who is the filmmaker who gave us Chronicle,
mm-hmm.
and who, based on the success of Chronicle, was hired to make the 2015 Fantastic Four.
Yes, he was.
Which was a debacle.
Yes.
Yeah. And weird thing happens to you sometimes, but not always. This is why the ways of Hollywood are still sometimes inscrutable to me, in that sometimes you suffer through a big budget disaster if you have been hired to be the director. And you move on to some new big thing. Like, everyone's like, oh, that's not your problem. That wasn't your fault. Here, direct a Jurassic Park movie. Like,
wasn't he going to direct a Jurassic Park movie? But then he, like, maybe said things he wasn't supposed to say about Fantastic Four, and then that's how he lost the gig.
I don't remember.
I'd have to go look it up, but I have a vague
recollection. Is that it? If you don't talk, If you don't speak out of turn about the disaster, then you get to go on and do something else that's
that
equally
big.
Be.
I think if you clam up, then at least they think, okay, well, then you're a white guy. You get all the chances in the world as long as you don't drag anybody else down with you. You know,
right? Well, he must have bitten the hand that fed him.
Apparently,
and someone took a dislike, and he was relieved of. Other projects that he had going on.
He's been in movie jail for a while.
So what he did was he went off and he wrote a movie about Al Capone. But he didn't write a movie about Al Capone during the fun gangster years. He wrote a movie about Al Capone.
The syphilis years.
During the last years. Sorry, the last year.
Yeah.
Of his life. He had served some time in prison for, I think it was like tax fraud or something, is what they got him for.
I think, yeah, tax evasion. Famously, that is what they...
And...
Charles Martin Smith and the Untouchables, man.
During his time in prison, the whole time he was in prison, he already had syphilis.
Yeah.
That was sort of eating him inside.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time he got out and was home alone during his life, well, not alone with his family.
Well, they let him out because he was not going to harm anybody.
His body was failing him, and he had dementia.
Yeah.
It was such advanced syphilis that he was dying. And that's the movie. The movie is Al Capone in his mansion, having hallucinations about the past. And his wife, played here by Linda Cardellini, Al Capone, by the way, played by Tom Hardy.
And how?
His wife tending to him, his family sometimes around, sometimes not. But it is a story of a man in a bathrobe and a diaper shooting a gold-plated machine gun at anything that he feels like shooting it at, singing songs and having bad dreams and falling down, soiling himself many times over.
Think you've seen the movie about the old gangster looking back on his life?
Yes, that was The Irishman.
You have not seen it exactly like this.
You have not.
And maybe by the time this is over, you'll think about why you've never seen a movie.
It's
like
a bad dream. Really. Mm-hmm. It's like a bad dream of a film in that it's about a man who is tormented inside by the life he has made. But without the mental capacity at this point in his existence to speak clearly about it. So like you watch something like The Irishman, and De Niro is an unreliable narrator. He refuses to be fully, you know, culpable for the things he's done.
Capone can't even rationalize.
But yeah, Al Capone can't even have a rational thought in this film. But to that end, Tom Hardy delivers the kind of performance that we have now come to expect from Tom Hardy in every third or fourth film he makes, where there are very few sentences spoken. Instead, there's this. And I'm not talking about a Bane sort of thing where he's like making announcements in a mask that make him hard to understand. I'm just talking about the grunt performance that Tom Hardy can do and still captivate you. and yet has now become such a feature of his acting process, depending on the film itself, that when you walk into a movie now that stars Tom Hardy, you think, are you going to speak? Or are you going to go,
yeah.
Because that's this movie.
I have a theory, and this is completely, I'm totally pulling this out of thin air. I have no basis of fact on this.
Yeah.
But I can't help thinking that Josh Trank in movie jail, wanting to get this script made, feels passionate about it. Tom Hardy signs on knowing that he's the reason this movie is getting made.
Yes.
And that if Josh Trank wants to direct him, Tom Hardy might take it under advisement, but overall, Tom Hardy is going to do what Tom Hardy feels like doing.
Can we consult Charlize Theron on this? Is she available to talk to us?
I have this hunch. Whether or not he signed on thinking this was going to be the deal, you know deep down, he's like, this is my concept of the character, and if you don't like it, tough, because without me, there is no movie.
I don't disbelieve that.
Yeah. Like just a theory.
I think maybe that in the world of who's got the juice.
Right. Because I love Tom Hardy as an actor. Yeah. Locke, one of my favorite films.
Locke is really good.
Of the 2010s, mm-hmm. That movie is all him. It is like this exceptional performance. Bronson, the stuff that he's done for Christopher Nolan. But I think that he is not, I don't want to say prone, but he is occasionally given to excess that I find less entertaining to watch. That the movie with the really good sweaters where he's a bootlegger with Shia LaBeouf.
that was a grunt performance.
That was a total grunt performance. That was like I didn't know you could whisper through your nostrils, but that's what he does in that movie. Taboo, which I just found kind of all but unwatchable by the end of the first season.
Love that show.
And now this, it's like, oh, this is going to be that Tom Hardy.
I'm currently in the phase of he's my boyfriend. Part of his career.
Where other people don't understand, but you love
Yeah. I'm currently in the phase, I'm in the phase of our relationship. me and Tom.
Yes.
Where even if it's a grunt performance like this, where all he's doing is like, I'll keep watching. Or if it's something like Legend, where he's unintelligible in
as twins. Another one.
Like, I needed the captions.
He was, doubly unfathomable in that movie.
Wasn't a grunt performance. That was just a accent so thick, I defy you to understand me.
Yeah, I certainly never confused which twin was talking, but I didn't know what either twin was saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm into all of it.
I think conceptually, this idea in the hands of a better filmmaker might have landed stronger. This notion of not only is this somebody who has done terrible things and we are coming in after his sort of years of, quote unquote glory, but he is, mentally, incapacitated and dealing with dementia and dealing with a body and mind that are both breaking down on him. All that on paper sounds fascinating. And I think offers a lot of opportunities that I don't think this movie necessarily takes full advantage of.
Linda Cardellini is great.
Always. Speaking of people from Scooby-Doo who didn't get hired back to be the voice of the cartoon.
We do not appreciate Linda Cardellini enough as a people.
As an audience.
I think she, if you look at her career since Freaks and Geeks, that was her first thing, right? Was it not?
That registered.
Early on, anyway. The earliest thing I remember her from.
Yeah.
20 years of Linda Cardellini, and she has only become more and more indispensable.
Mm-hmm.
She shows up as the wife so often.
Yeah.
And yet, she will take that wife role and make you remember her as the best thing in the movie.
I.e. Green Book.
Green Book, yeah. She's the reason at the end of Green Book, if you are moved at the end of Green Book, she's the reason.
Yeah.
I
have not yet watched season 2 of Dead to Me, but she's amazing in the first season. Right. I'm hearing nothing but raves about the new one. So,
as character actresses in their, what is she, 40 now maybe?
45.
Oh, she's 45.
Yeah.
Oh, so she was 25 playing 17
in Freaks and Geeks.
I get it. Like Jessica Roth
in Valley Girl.
32 playing.
Well, she was 28.
Okay, whatever. Still 28 playing 17.
Yeah.
You know, this generation of younger actors, you know, we're going to see her have this long career of really cool character performances.
Mm-hmm.
That's what she's become.
Yeah.
And that's what she's great at.
Like even in Dead to Me, like it's a co-lead, but it is a complicated and odd character,
yeah.
You know? Yeah, no, she's going to be the kind of person who does like, she's going to star in really good indies. She's going to steal scenes in big dumb movies like Green Book and, you know, the Avengers movies where she pops up with, you know, as Mrs. Hawkeye.
Right.
And then like she is going to get hopefully at some point the kind of film like, what was that amazing Lois Smith movie where the Michael Almereyda film where about the woman who gets older and she's got the her husband comes back as sort of a therapeutic thing. Marjorie Prime.
Yes.
A movie I have.
We had to stop the recording and remember the name of that film.
I have long championed on this show.
Such a good movie.
Yeah. It's like in her 60s, I think. Like she'll get like that kind of role and everybody will go, oh yeah, Linda Cardellini, you've always been great.
Right. Right. So here she's great as Al Capone's wife.
She is. And I liked Matt Dillon.
He's
in a couple scenes.
Not much in the movie, but you know.
I just was reminded that I like Matt Dillon. I haven't seen him in a while.
Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah, I mean, this isn't a successful film, but there are elements of it that are fascinating ideas that I wanted to see, you know, executed in a different way, I guess.
I mean, you kind of have to see it for the things that it's trying to do and for the things that Tom Hardy is putting himself through, I guess.
Yes.
But is that good?
There's a bit of a pile-on happening right now about it. And I always think that's a little unfair, unless it's just a total fiasco.
Sure.
This movie isn't a fiasco. It's just strange.
It's trying for something,
it's
which
trying
is
to
more
be
than
something.
A lot of fiascos yeah. ever do, you know?
Yeah. You watched something that I did not, called Mother's Little Helper or
yes.
Helpers.
Yes.
Please tell me what this is.
This is a film we screened at Outfest last year, so I can't review it, but, I liked it. And so I would like to talk about it and let people know that it is available streaming.
Is it on a specific platform or just like iTunes?
I don't know, but right. I'm sure. Here's the thing that I've learned in all of this is that if you Google the title of a movie and then the word streaming, it will tell you pretty much where to go find the thing. So Mother's Little Helpers is an ensemble piece, and the ensemble kind of helped write it. They did it sort of Mike Lee style, where I think they originally came up with sort of, you know, these are the characters and this is the broad outline of the story, but then we're going to sort of get together in a room and figure it out. The director and one of the co-stars of the film is a woman named Kestrin Pantera. And she and Breida Wohl and Milana Vaintrub and Sam Littlefield play the four children of a character played by Melanie Hutzel, formerly of SNL. She is a woman who was took an iconic photo like in the early 70s that became an album cover and never quite lived up to that potential again. But sort of ran these sort of like, you know, cool, you know, music circles. Anyway, she is on her deathbed. Her children have gathered to take care of her. The kids are all different from each other, but they all feel like they were raised by this woman.
Okay.
And in taking care of her in her final days, they, you know, come to a lot of realizations about her, about themselves, about each other. You know, structurally, this is an indie you've seen before. You know, it's the dysfunctional family comedy drama, you know, in the final days of the matriarch, and sort of, you know, revelations occur. But within that, it's really well done. These characters kind of, you know, pop off the screen. They do feel like genuine, organic people. The revelations also sort of feel ingrained in the material. They aren't just sort of like twists that some screenwriter, you know, right, came up with.
Yeah.
So, you know, on the scale at which it's operating, I think it's doing what it wants to do really well.
Okay.
So, you know, if that sounds like your kind of jam, you might enjoy it.
I don't want to be dismissive of it because I haven't seen it and I don't know anything about it. So I have these trust you on this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I'm just being real here.
Also, a supporting role from...
I have seen some of the films you have programmed for Outfest.
Well, okay.
And
But I don't endorse all of those movies. Some of those movies are movies that you show at a film festival because you show them at a film festival, and there's other factors that play into it.
Well, the factor is always that what batch of queer indie films have come out this year, and if there aren't enough good ones, then you pad them out in the schedule of a queer film festival.
Well, that might have been the case when I, you know, began working in queer film festivals years ago.
Right.
Every year now, I would say there is always at least one or two movies that I really thought were good that wind up getting left on the table. Because, not because, you know, queer indie cinema is necessarily better than it used to be.
Yeah.
There's just more of it.
Right.
And, you know, as the math tells you, if 15% of everything is, you know, is going to be not crap, if the more movies there are, the more movies there are in that 15%.
Right.
And there are movies that I've programmed for Outfest that I would not talk about in this venue because I programmed them because, you know, there was a certain person involved or because they, right, you know, it was a story.
And you do not act alone.
Exactly. That also.
You're on a
yes,
team.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So
your voice, your vote doesn't always carry
exactly
final say.
You know,
well, it never carries final say.
Sometimes it's a movie because it's from like a country that we'd never get queer films from.
Right,
before,
right. You want that out there. Right.
You know, like, here's a pro tip for any filmmakers listening that, mm-hmm, I always like to share. If you're trying to get your movie into queer film festivals, make a movie with a positive bisexual character in a leading role. That jumps you to the head of the line because every LGBT film festival, like the T has really gotten better over the last years. L and G has always been in good shape, but B is always a hunt.
There is a famine
of B.
Of bi beauty.
Yes. Anyway, all that is to say, I don't necessarily endorse every movie that Outfest ever showed, and I don't talk about it on this show.
Yeah.
But I do endorse this one, and I do want to talk about this one, because I think it's quite well done, and I think a lot of the people involved in it are very talented.
Okay. So, Mother's Little Helpers.
Yes. Also includes a supporting role from my beloved Tara Karsian, who always makes me laugh in a movie.
Mm.
So, you know, check it out.
You guys... Cinema Guild.
Oh boy.
My darling, my Cinema Guild,
mm-hmm,
has released Liberté. Liberté is the latest film from Albert Serra. He is a Spanish director. He's Catalan.
Mm-hmm.
He is responsible for The Death of Louis XIV, Story of My Death, going all the way back to 2003, 2006, Crespia, the film Not the Village, and Quixotic.
What is his thing with, like, France of the later monarchy? His last three films,
yes,
were The Death of Louis XIV.
Yes.
Followed by The Sun King, which is also about Louis XIV.
Yes.
And then this is a movie about people who have been exiled by Louis XVI.
What he does is take historical settings and turn them sideways to fit his themes. Liberté began its life.
Wait, before you get into all this,
yes.
I just want to point out, Dave and I watched this movie cold.
Yes.
We didn't know what it was going to be about.
Nope.
We didn't know the backstory
Correct.
To it.
All I knew is that we had never reviewed an Albert Serra film.
And it played at Cannes last year.
And it won a jury prize at Cannes last year.
That was all I knew.
Yeah.
Everything that Dave is about to tell you is stuff that he discovered after the fact.
Doing research after the fact, this is what I know.
And thus, of no help to us while we were watching. Proceed.
It began its life as a stage production at Berlin's Volksbühne. And what I have read about the stage production is that it very closely mirrors what exists in the film. It was met at the time with mixed reactions, very much like
you don't say.
The film itself is meeting with extremely mixed reactions. Then it became a two-screen installation at the Sofia Arena in Madrid.
Reina Sofia, sorry.
In Madrid. And now it is a theatrical film. And the people who are in the stage play and the performance.
Yeah.
The people who are in the performance and in the two-screen installation, many of them are here in the film. Serra works with the same folks over and over again. Most of them are not actors. I went and did my homework on the people in the film. They are painters, other kinds of artists, performance people. They run the gamut. Now, Helmut Berger, big Eurostar of the 60s and 70s, he is in this as well.
Yes.
And apparently he was in the performance, the Berlin performance, too.
Okay. Shall I endeavor to synopsize?
Do you want to?
No. If you've got something ready to go, do it.
I've got something ready to go. Okay. There are a group of aristocratic libertines who have been exiled from the court of Louis the 16th, who was extremely conservative. So they go find a German duke. And this particular German duke, the Duke de Walcken, and that's Helmut Berger, a famous seducer. Now, this is the late 18th century.
Right.
The French Revolution has not taken place yet.
Because Louis is still on the throne.
But they've got to get out.
Yeah.
Because the king is not down for their particular brand of free thinking and, let's be real, super debauchery.
Yeah.
Okay.
This takes a left at ribaldry and goes right into like Michael Fassbender in shame territory.
So the beginning of the film is setting up this idea of we want to go to a place where we can be free to express ourselves sexually in any way that we feel like. And they discuss the ways that they feel like. The things they talk about and the things that the film eventually shows you happening between the actors are things that I cannot really discuss
on a clean podcast.
On a podcast that has been marked on Apple Podcasts as clean versus explicit. But I will tell you that this is an explicit film. It's a very, very, very explicit film.
And yet, not erotic in the slightest.
It owes a... Well, here's... I'm going to keep telling you what happens. The entire rest of the film takes place in the forest outside of this, outside of this estate.
At night.
The entire film is one night of sexual boundary pushing. Extreme stuff.
Mm-hmm.
if you have any understanding of kink communities, you will be aware that everything you see in this film is something that many, many consenting adults do with each other.
Sure. It all has a name.
Some of the things that you see in this film are things that a very small number of consenting adults like to do with each other. Now, what complicates this story is that they are also looking to perhaps kidnap some women from a convent and turn them into libertines, which becomes an issue of, consent. That was a concept apparently that was foreign to them in the late 18th century.
But you could also read it to where they talk a bigger game than they necessarily accomplish. And so part of me thinks, is this convent business just a scenario?
It might be.
Where women who are already in their circle pretend to be the kidnapped young virgin and, oh,
that is perhaps true, because the women involved and the men involved, all of them are very vocal in their demands for what they want
right.
to happen in any particular moment.
And
move around each other in this strange sort of circular dance, which very much resembles sort of old-time queer cruising.
Yeah.
In
the woods.
And this is in the woods, yeah. And they are insatiable in their desire for more and more. And going back to what you said about Michael Fassbender in Shame, they are exhausted. All of them. They, as you said, they talk a big game. The verbal discussions of their scenarios are frequently wilder than the things you're seeing enacted.
Yeah.
Because they have become bored with the process.
Right. And I want to clarify, when I talk about how unerotic this movie is, I'm not kink shaming.
No, nothing, of course you're not.
Nothing that happens in this movie looks like it's enjoyable to anyone. least of all the people committing the act. They all seem... I mean, every so often...
Can we make an exception for old Syphilis Nose?
Okay, Syphilis Nose is throwing himself into it with vigor, I grant you. But most everybody else feels like... they all look like they're already thinking about the next thing. You know, like they've captured this scenario, and now that they're in it, they're already bored and they want to move on to whatever the next thing is. And it is all shot in a way where it's
gorgeously.
Yeah. But it's like it's all very shadowy and half viewed. But again, not in a way that is sexy, just in a way that is like all I could think about was like. Ants, and you know, because it's like you've got Syphilis Nose, and other people have like sores or.
This is a backup. Weird... Let's back up just a minute. There's a character in the film,
yes,
whose face is
he's missing half of his nose.
Yeah, partially. You know, he's losing parts of his body.
Yeah.
He has sores. When you see him nude, you see the sores, and you do see him nude. You do see him. He's one of the few people in the film who how do I say this? He's ready to go.
Yes.
Okay. and
that's part of the thing. The fact that everybody else isn't ready to go shows you how not into it they are.
He's ready to go, and he is the one to whom people are doing the most things.
Yeah.
Some of the most, perhaps. To some folks, outlandish things. Mm-hmm. I had a conversation with a friend who watched it a few days before we did, and we were discussing the Gates of Hell scene.
Yeah.
Where the man says, "Open the gates of hell."
Yeah.
I don't want to talk about what's going on.
That's when I almost quit.
Because we were at a bit of a disagreement about what was going on in the Open the Gates of Hell scene. And I said, well, you know, if someone tells you to open the gates of hell, I think they want you to open the gates of hell, if you know what I mean. Yeah. And so
What you think is happening, friend, I think it's maybe something a little more extreme than what you think is happening. So
the movie, to its credit, does not.
You don't see
it either way.
Yeah, you don't. You are left to guess. But the point of this is not what is done or who is doing it to whom.
Right.
We live in an authoritarian age. It's increasing. It's getting worse worldwide. We're watching this happen in country after country after country. And in spite of the extreme nature of the things that happen in this film, and in spite of the strange emotionless quality of it, which reminded me in a way of Cronenberg's Crash, in that you have people who are constantly seeking more and more, like higher and higher stakes. And when they don't ever really get what they want, they console each other by saying, well, maybe next time.
Yeah.
Well, the maybe next time in this movie just keeps going all night long as the characters, you know, come together, pull apart, move on to other people. They do so in discarded carriages quite often, which makes...
like aristocratic cosplay.
Part of the folks, you know, voyeurs and some of them exhibitionists, but it turns you, the audience member, also into that, you know, voyeuristic person.
Because you're looking through a window now.
You're not just looking through a window. You're looking through a window at night.
Yeah.
And with cinematography and a very naturalistic, you know, set in a forest, you know, that branches, leaves, shadow, moonlight are all obscuring the action often. Not in a glorious way like Vitellina Varela, which is also a film that's entirely in shadow and darkness. But in a way that makes you, again, into a voyeur, because you're like, come on, Branch, get out of the way so I can see what, who is that? What are they, who's doing what? Okay. I see what's going on.
Never mind. Branches, please. Yeah. A lot of the men are wearing powdered wigs, so you're not always sure who's who.
Who's who, right.
Maybe if I had gone in forearmed with all of this information about the roots of this production and all that, that might have made it. This was agony to sit through.
I'm glad I watched it. I think it's a significant film. It's certainly a radical piece of filmmaking. I don't want to see it again.
I'm
glad it exists as yet another example of what movies can be when they aren't afraid. You know,
it is 100% what it is.
The stuff in it didn't shock me because I've seen all three Human Centipede films, and so in that context, what can shock you? But yeah, it's not fun.
No,
it's just significant.
Yeah, I admire the chutzpah certainly, and there's not a whiff of compromise to this.
Oh, absolutely, no compromises.
I'll give
going
it that.
Yeah.
But just as a viewing experience, it was mostly unbearable, and it might have been less unbearable, I think, if I'd known what I was in for and what the intent was. But just to be thrown into it cold was like, oh my God, get me out of here. I was kind of hoping that the gates of hell were going to be what I thought it was, just so I'd have an excuse to walk away.
Three cheers to these actors too. They all commit.
They commit.
They do what's in the script.
Yes.
So, know yourself before you sit down to this.
Yeah.
It's streaming. It's from Cinema Guild. You can rent it on the internet. It was meant to be theatrically released. It is now streaming.
Yes.
And then we watched from Grasshopper Films. This is like the 1-2 punch of my two favorite two favorite distributors.
Neither of which are doing themselves any favors in my book with these two movies. But
we watched The Plagiarists.
Yes.
Why don't you explain what happens in The Plagiarist?
The Plagiarist...
Plagiarists. There are multiple plagiarists. Yes.
First of all, it's shot on what would appear to be VHS or something. It's the aspect ratio is sort of like
it's
old.
Shot on the camera that they talk about.
Oh, okay, there we go. Okay,
it's an old news. It's a old Betamax news camera.
Yes. Okay, so that explains a lot,
and that's why it looks like it looks.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
All right. So a pair of Manhattanites in upstate New York have been visiting a friend's house. Their car won't start. It's winter time. This guy lets them come in. They wind up having dinner there and staying the night. There are unanswered questions regarding why is there a kid in the house? To whom does he belong?
Right.
The guy has this whole room that is a treasure trove of like old camera equipment. And mm-hmm. One of the Manhattanites is a cameraman who may or may not be an aspiring filmmaker.
Right.
His girlfriend is a would-be novelist / memoirist.
Mm-hmm.
At some point in the evening, their host has a conversation with the writer that involves a lengthy and sort of lyrical childhood memory. Then we cut to springtime, and they are once again driving to upstate New York to visit that same friend. And the woman is reading a book and realizes that the guy's lyrical story of childhood was lifted directly from its pages. It's some Scandinavian author's memoir. And so she's freaked out about that, and it makes her question everything else about that night and who this guy was and what was he about and all this stuff. And the boyfriend does not see what the big deal is. And they argue a lot about everything. And then they get to the friend's house, and we find out the boyfriend used to work for the friend, but now she's friends with both of them. She's really encouraging of the writer to write her stuff. And and then it maybe loops itself. Mm-hmm. It goes in a circle, and I don't know what the point of any of this was. And I hated every single person. I was reminded of Matt Zollerseitz's Max Cady rule, where I wanted Robert De Niro or Robert Mitchum's character from Cape Fear to show up and terrorize all four of these protagonists because I hated all of them. I'm sure after the fact you read something that explains this thing.
Not as much after the fact as Liberté. With Liberté.
Okay.
Because while we were watching it, I was way more into it than you.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you what I didn't know going in. The actor who plays the guy whose house they stop at, his name is Michael Clip Payne.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's what I did not know about Michael Clip Payne. Since 1977, Michael Clip Payne has been a member of Parliament and Funkadelic.
Uh-huh.
That has nothing to do with the film.
Yeah, it never comes up. Like, he has no backstory.
Here's the other thing I learned after watching the film. The director of this film might not really exist.
Okay.
The jury is out on that one.
He's got two credits on IMDb.
He may be sort of a pseudonym for whoever else is the creative driving force of the film. I don't know.
And his other movie is about a couple stuck in a quaint country retreat.
Yes.
Okay, dude, you have a wheelhouse, and I don't want to go in it anymore.
Well, I do want to go in it again, because the wheelhouse is a weird one.
Mm.
Yes, the characters are insufferable.
Yes.
All of them. Mm-hmm. Like, all four of the folks in this movie. And the kid, too. Why not? Let's just throw the kid in. The kid doesn't have any dialogue, but hate that kid. But from the beginning,
the opening shot, I'm thinking, why does it look like this? What am I being told about this film and about these characters because this film is shot on a what used to be considered, you know, top-of-the-line piece of equipment in the late 80s, early 90s.
And which took me back to way too many feature films I'd seen in the early 90s that were shot in this exact same way.
Yes, 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 yes. What am I being told about the world of independent film here? What am I being told about nostalgia for those moments? What am I being told about this story that feels like it could be a bit from a Seinfeld episode? Where clueless, young, white members of the creative class, and I get that in quotes, because he does TV spots for Evian, but he wants to be a filmmaker, and he keeps insisting that he doesn't.
Yeah.
She is not writing a memoir that might also be a novel.
Right.
While simultaneously reading My Struggle. Now, if you don't know what My Struggle is, that is the 6-novel autobiographical series of books from Carl Ove Nosgaard, who is a Norwegian writer, and it was a big literary sensation.
It's the same title as Hitler's memoir.
Yes. And there was a point,
I'm sure,
to that. So automatically, you are meant to associate the act of reading that book with the act of not writing anything. And someone who just endlessly talks in circles about how they are not really a memoirist, they're a novelist. And I'm not really a filmmaker, I just make TV spots, but I'm really a filmmaker. And this older man that we run into who helps us, who provides concrete, real-time assistance to us, recites a passage from the very book that the young woman is reading.
Is she reading it in that first part, though? Or should we
yes.
read it later?
It's in the car.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't catch that.
And because I looked at it, I was like, oh, well, of course she's reading that because she's that person. The man is older. He's black. And that informs the things that they are talking about, that the couple is talking about, because they find themselves sort of mired in confusion after they meet him. You know, he recites this long passage from the very book that she is reading.
She discovers
later. And they discover it later, and they feel violated by this.
He seems to not see why she cares.
And they are dancing around the implications of their assumptions about race and about class and about who they are.
Sure.
And when they meet with their friend finally in the summertime, the woman named Allison, who is apparently friends with this guy named Clip.
Yeah.
But she plays it off like she's not very close to him. Implication, she's having sex with him. Because the woman that they hear having sex with him in the beginning of the movie is never seen. And there's a look that she gives them where they talk about him. She gives this face like, you met, when did you meet him? What night was this? Like, she was in that house. And so, and I'm kind of giving away too much, but also not, because it's such a strange movie about, you know, who gets to be, you know, who gets to be an artist, who gets to be wise, who gets to be, you know, thought of as good or thought of as suspect, who is stealing from whom. You know, do interactions that you don't like, do they take something away from you? That's really what I think all this is about. And formally, the film is also sort of giving you that stuff too. By at the very end of the movie, it just lists all the cultural references that have been included in the film, the book. Justin Chang.
Yes.
Justin Chang is in this movie on an NPR clip that they have, you know, put in the film of Justin and another film critic whose name I'm blanking on right now.
On Fresh Air, talking about You Were Never Here.
You Were Never Really Here.
Yeah.
All the music that was used in the film, they list as, like, stock music and where they got it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what movies do, though.
Yes, but... these are all, you know, objects, in a way, that have been incorporated into the construction of this narrative that is not just a story of these two dummies, which is what they are, but it is also a sort of puzzle about, you know, authenticity.
I think you were giving this movie... all kinds of credit, and I don't.
I've been thinking about this movie ever since we stopped watching it.
I don't think it's earned a fraction of this analysis, or you know, or if that's what they're trying to do.
I just sipped my iced tea because I'm right.
Fine, whatever, whatever. Kermit the Frog. I think this is this. I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. This movie is not, it doesn't have its head up its own keister as much as its characters do, because it is commenting on its characters doing that.
Right.
But
that's what I think.
But I think.
You're not meant to like
anyone. And I don't have to.
And you're not meant to always kind of know what their motivations are or, you know, even where you stand as a viewer with them.
I think it's like 80 minutes of solipsism, and I just
76 minutes.
Fine.
It's a very short film.
That's about one of the few things it has going for it.
It is decidedly the most meta thing that I have seen in forever.
That doesn't make it more interesting.
It is a film about being a film. It's a story about being a story. It's a...
yeah, oh yeah, no. It is one of those movies where people talk about cinema a lot. And boy, do I hate that. Yeah. Because to me, it feels like somebody took the dictum of like, oh, well, you know, write what you know. And all you know is film criticism. Then be a film critic. Don't make a movie about it. Know something else and write about that.
We will respectfully disagree.
Fair enough.
Because it's also not pretty to look at, and the performances are a weird sort of stilted.
It felt very mumblecore to me. I felt like I was plunged back into the early 2000s, that Greta Gerwig was going to come waltzing out at any moment. By the way, the puppy chair is coming on Fox Movies.
Oh.
I just put it in TiVo because I've never seen it.
How exciting. You know, this film might have a little nostalgia for Mumblecore, or it might be take a big dump on Mumblecore.
Are we now hitting the generation of filmmakers who were raised on Mumblecore and are now ready to make their own movies? Oh, no! Oh, boy. We have some letters.
Do we indeed?
We do.
Oh, look, Scam Likely is calling me right
now. Oh, tell Scam I said hey.
I love Scam. We need to hang out more when the pandemic is over. I'm going to pull up these letters.
Oh, before we get to letters, I have a quick recommendation. It's not a DVD pick this week.
Yeah.
There is a publishing house called Seventh Row that does sort of collections of film criticism where it'll be about a specific film or filmmaker. And they have just published Portraits of Resistance, The Cinema of Celine Sciamma.
Oh, wow.
So if you're a fan of Portrait of a Lady on Fire or Tom Girl or her other films, There's some really cool stuff here. You should check it out. You can go to the website Siamma Book, SCIMMABook.com. What do we got?
It's a letter from Theo. Hello, Alonzo and Dave. This is a reminder that I'm a big fan of your podcast. I'm very grateful that I get a new episode every week. Also, thank you for reading my last letter.
Oh, well, thank
Sorry that it was so long, but I guess that's who I am. When California's stay-at-home order began, my sister decided to watch a new movie every day. I decided to follow suit. This has led to some wonderful and not-so-wonderful discoveries, as well as a furthering of my film knowledge. Here are some lukewarm takes on what I have discovered. The first movie I watched was Only Angels Have Wings, 1939.
Oh, fun.
An odd but good film. I'm not entirely sure the morality of the film has aged perfectly, but then again, things used to break a lot. Things used to break a lot with little ways for people to be safe. I don't know what that sentence means. Which is fine, because sometimes I say sentences and I don't know what they mean either. Or maybe I'm endorsing a bad kind of capitalism. Shrug. I finally watched Metropolis, 1927, and while I enjoyed it a lot, at a certain point, some older films feel more interesting as historical text than pieces of entertainment. I did really enjoy learning that Blade Runner was just straight ripping off some of it.
Have you seen the Madonna Express Yourself video? Look out.
The sexual politics of Cover Girl, 1944, made me wince. It's also a bummer because what seems to be a vehicle for Rita Hayworth is more notable for the Gene Kelly number where he dances with himself. Just an aside here, now we've talked about Only Angels Have Wings and whether or not the morality has aged well or the sexual politics of Cover Girl from 1944 have aged well. That's cinema.
Yeah,
it's a document of its moment.
Yes.
You're going to find stuff in the films of the, you know, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, etc.
80s.
To be objectionable now. The people who made them were largely, you know, the folks in power. You know, white men. Straight white men. And they were often really comfortable with stuff that, you know, lots of folks aren't comfortable with anymore. And that's a reflection of how they ran the show back then. So that's, you know.
We'll get Mickey Rooney to play the Japanese landlord. It'll be hilarious.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. Here we go. The next part. I did not care for the Western film Red Sun, 1971.
Don't know it.
But seeing Toshiro Mifune, Charles Bronson, Ursula Andress, and Alain Delon on screen together was like watching some Fast and Furious franchise of a yesteryear that never was.
Wow. I could look that one up.
I had more fun watching Jason and the Argonauts. Well, how
could you not?
Sure, yeah. 1963. Then I realized I would, in particular the skeleton fight at the end.
Yes.
The story makes no sense as a feature film, but who cares? To follow that note, Invention for Destruction, 1958, also known as The Fabulous World of Jules Verne, was another really neat movie. Story is goofy and empty, but again, more cool animation, please. I've never seen my own mental state so well depicted as it was in 1995's Safe. I'm not even close to being a rich housewife living in the suburbs of Los Angeles, but that's the power of cinema. I'm pretty sure it's a great movie, but I couldn't tell you. It's too close to home. I'm laughing because that movie has stayed with me for 25 years.
And I occasionally will call him Carol Weiss.
It just so happens that I share a last name with the character that Julianne Moore plays. Yes. So, The Night Porter, 1974, is one of the most challenging pieces of cinema I have ever had to watch. As time goes on, there are less and less taboos. But this film, despite being 46 years old, still feels provocative.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
A White, White Day, 2020, was a beautiful movie about how men aren't good at dealing with their feelings.
True.
Yes. It is the early lead for my favorite movie of the year, though that pool isn't very deep, sadly. To say I enjoyed Alice in Wonderland, 1951, is to say that I enjoy fever dreams, I guess. I've grown up in a world that takes Disney for granted as a mainstay of life, but watching this, I think it really proves that human memory and nostalgia is imperfect. There you go. Thank you for that letter.
We appreciate your listening. We appreciate the letters.
Nathan says, I just listened to your recent recommendation of Celine and Julie Go Boating, and I had to write in. I'm so glad to find someone else who has seen this movie and loves it the way I do. I've been floating alone in my pro Celine and Julie boat for so long, and I'm thrilled to have company. If anything, it's nice to have someone confirm that I hadn't just had a wild hallucination. I saw it a few years ago at a theater and then was frustrated that I couldn't find a way to buy the movie that did not include buying a British DVD player or a $200 VHS copy. As soon as it showed up on the Criterion Channel, I told my brother that he needed to see it as soon as possible, because if they get rid of it, I don't know how he would ever be able to get his hands on it. He told me that he loved the first half, but got bored when they go into the house, and I don't even know how to make sense of that. Because,
what?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because the first half is the part that we were watching while we watched it for the first time back in the 90s. When we watched it, we were like, what's that? Why? Why? How long, how much longer does this have to go? Oh, it's 2.5. It's 3 hours long. We're only halfway done. But then they go in the house.
And then it's all.
And then it's all. Yeah. So he watched it and thought the first half was the interesting great one. And the second half was the. Okay. All right. I'm going to continue reading this letter.
Takes all kinds, I suppose.
It is such a fun and different and trippy movie. I love it, and I cannot second your recommendation enough. While I'm writing and talking about long movies, thank you for recommending Satan Tango.
Ah.
I went to see it at my local theater on your recommendation.
Wow.
The theater has a screen that had been set up in an ornate but unused gym on the third floor of an arts college.
Wow.
Which felt kind of perfect, all things considered. There were 2 20-minute intermissions, which was great because it was a nice chance to get ice cream and tacos. Finally, I would advocate that any movie that is going to be longer than 2 hours and 10 minutes should have a break where I can get ice cream. I saw on Wikipedia that Bela Tarr wants the whole thing to be shown without interruption, and I turned on him immediately.
Bela, honey.
Even if Bela Tarr has no need to eat, drink, use the bathroom, which I bet he does after a certain amount of cat torture and suicide, it really helps to take a walk around the block. I feel like I lived a month in that day. About six hours in, when I was starting to really hit a wall, I realized only a couple days had passed in the movie, and I felt my brain melt. Thank you for all you do. It's so comforting to have 2 people I trust sorting through films and pointing me in the right direction. It's also nice to hear people talking more pretentiously about film than me, so I don't have to feel self-conscious. Hey, now.
Oh, Nathan. Sick burn.
I ain't pretentious.
Sure, Jan.
I started listening a little less than 2 years ago after being incredibly moved. Incredibly moved by Dave on Who Shot You, talking about how attractive James Gandolfini was.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. It was an episode of Who Shot You where we were talking about the unlikely screen crush.
Yeah, I think it was when Snatched came out.
Maybe.
No, I Feel Pretty.
I Feel Pretty. That's yes. We were talking about I Feel Pretty. And I just talked about how, like, I had a super crush on James Gandolfini.
Yeah.
He was beautiful.
He was.
He was a beautiful man.
He was indeed.
And I miss him. Mm. Since then, you've introduced me to Infinite Football, A Faithful Man, my first Hallmark movies, The Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and Bacon Buddies. What a great influence.
Wait, which one's A Faithful Man?
I don't know. I can't remember. Which one is a faithful man?
I was hoping you knew. No.
It's the title of a film I'm blanking on. I don't even know what the movie that was. Once you look it up, while I finish reading this letter.
I am.
Finally, just to stick my nose in a fight that I think has already been settled, I love Claire Denis, but I saw Beau Travail with a straight guy I was pretending not to have feelings for, and even I didn't feel this supposed heat steam Dave is trying to pretend this movie has. I am Team Alonzo here, 100%.
Booyah!
Nathan, we used to be friends. I don't know that we are anymore.
A faithful man.
I think you have to make it up to me now.
A faithful man is that Louis Garrel movie that he directed, that he's in with Letitia Costa.
And oh, that's Rose right. Depp. Yes. Here is a list to knife.
Okay.
I already talked about and know your thoughts on Celine and Julie Go Boating, so I will mark it as honorable mention now, even though it would normally be on this list. A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. Yes.
Still haven't seen it.
Three Colors Red.
Oh, yeah. Best of the trilogy.
And I haven't seen that.
Ooh.
Yeah. Happy Christmas.
Yeah. That's the, speaking of Mumblecore, it's the Joe Swanberg movie with, I think, Anna Kendrick? Anyway, yeah, that's a good one.
On the Beach at Night Alone, which is gorgeous. Wonderful. Night Moves from Kelly Reichardt.
Maybe my least favorite Kelly Reichardt movie, but it's still pretty
good.
Did you
see On the Beach at Night Alone with Me?
I did not.
Okay.
Night Moves is her, like, eco-thriller.
Yes.
It's good. It's just, yeah. It's not, I prefer her other mode.
Before Sunset?
Oh, yeah.
Funny Games. Which one?
They're identical.
I know they are.
That is a movie that I despise, but if it's a movie you admire, I certainly will say that much like, you know, Liberté and even Capone, it is uncompromising in doing what it's doing. I happen to loathe what it's doing, but it is, I can't deny that it's doing it. So I'll give you that.
Funny Games was a very effective film. Mm-hmm. And after it was over, I was angry at Michael Haneke.
Me too.
Yeah.
But I still think, you know, I get why somebody would respect it for what it's doing.
The next one is You've Got Mail.
Wow.
Listen.
Okay, not my favorite Nora Ephron and not nearly as good as The Shop Around the Corner. But it does have Meg Ryan type.
Parker Posey's in that movie.
And Parker Posey's in it. I guess we'll let you have that one.
The Philadelphia Story.
Oh, yes.
And Phantom Thread.
Okay.
Dude, you're 100% knife.
You are. 110% even with Celine and Julie.
Well, you don't like Beau Travail?
Yeah, 120%.
I don't even know what to think anymore, Nathan.
Uh-huh.
I don't. It's a sad day for our relationship.
Go curl up in your corner of lies, Dave Weiss. Is that it? Are we done?
We're done. That's it. It's time for some lunch.
Okay.
On this here Tuesday afternoon.
Go check out our friends on the internet. Listen to what Bibbs and Whitney are up to on the Critically Acclaimed Network. And check out Schmoes Know, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, The Comics Canon, Sewers of Paris, All Things Cozy, Deck the Hallmark, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Big Fat Gay Podcast, The Criterion Cast, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts.
Did you mention Waiting to Exhale?
Oh, good heavens, yes.
Because you're on it.
Check out Waiting to Exhale, always lovely, but this week in particular, they had me and Guinevere Turner on to talk about the debacle that is Ryan Murphy's Hollywood.
And then they had Guy on for a part two.
Yes, which I think might be a Patreon exclusive.
Okay, it
is. So, yeah. But anyway, Waiting to Exhale.
Karen Winter. And Winter Mitchell from the podcast Pop Rocket,
yes.
our beloved, late, lamented Pop Rocket.
Yes, they're doing wonderful work over at Waiting to Exhale. Yeah. Do check that out as well.
Yeah.
The Big Fat Gay Podcast, Secretly Timid. Subscribe to this show on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, leave us a 5-star review. We'll read it on the show.
Yeah.
These 5-star reviews do help. Also helping is the positive feedback that we get in all of the places that we stream, like Spotify and CastBox and Google Play and Stitcher Radio, thelounge.com. Thank you, Blue, for... for our theme music. Go check out his stuff. It's always fun. His YouTube channel is Bluetopia, B-L-E-U-T-O-P-I-A. Catch up with his latest jams. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. And hey, we have a Patreon.
Yeah.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife. Oodles of extra content, including Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, where we focus on one individual title for anywhere from 20 minutes to until we stop talking. Who knows?
Yeah.
LKTV, a podcast of the television, and Linoleum Knife and Fork, a food podcast hosted by two film critics, Linoleum Knights. Also, T-shirts and mugs and Christmas ornaments. Also, private knife personalized episodes. Also, monthly club meetings where we get together and watch a Netflix movie. Also, Patreon.com/linoleumknife. You'll be glad you did. Thank you all for listening. Have a good week.
You might be glad you did.
I want to say you will.
Okay.
Take care of yourselves and take care of each other. And until next time.
Goodbye.